is a little button on this transformer called an on-off button. Time backstage, and usually I get pretty depressed before I go on. That's the nature of it. About 2 hours before showtime, I just want to cut my throat and get really grim, and I've never known why. But it happened so regularly that I was disturbed that I felt so good when I came out of here. I didn't know what to expect, you know. I think it's all right. It's nice to know, actually, when you're going to get depressed. Usually, you know, most people don't know that. It just comes upon us and we don't know why. I know. And then you come out and you are erased. It's automatic. That's the hook, I think, for everybody. It's the erasure. So, you know, what's left to be depressed? It's just poof. Great job. Thank you. laying on its supported by its side on the floor, and I put this guitar down through it. Not all the way through, obviously, but it did require some professional help. I'm really not a good guy for a guitar to run into. I don't treat them very well. Matter of fact, I was in the first house that I lived in, and I was born to rent. I've learned this in the last 5 years. To hell with houses, I don't know. I can't imagine now that I owned one. This thing, I realize it. Never mind. I can be a little sensitive to that subject. And now I've forgotten what the hell I was telling you about. I wrote this. I wrote this as exorcism, this tune. When I was it was the summer before I went into the seventh grade. I was about 33 years old. And I was standing in my front yard like a lawn jockey in my front yard, another house. I was there being inculcated by the house. And a couple kids walked by and said, we want you to show up in somebody's backyard tonight. We're going to all be there and have a sort of a party. And I got depressed then, too. I didn't want to do that. At the time, all I wanted to do was be Preston Epps. Does anybody remember Preston Epps? Wise choice, you're already there. He was a bongo player. He put out a record called Bongo Rock. I'd have my own bongos. They'd be set up just for me. Anyhow, so I decided for some reason to be, try to be gracious about it. And went. And when I got there, I was met by a small bunch of kids, and I was told there were two girls standing over here. I was told that I had to select one of them. This is Muskogee, Oklahoma. If you're lonely, go to Muskogee, Oklahoma. I don't know if they asked these women if they want to be involved in this process. And I did actually wonder that at the time. At any rate, I didn't know how to, what do I have to go on? But I didn't say that. They intuited my lack of data, and Sammy Lewis, one of the two girls, threw me to the ground and landed on my shoulders with her knees, and she kissed me. At least, technically, it was a kiss. It's more like, I'd come into town with my grandmother on a bus. It was more like the bus depot that we landed in. It wasn't the kiss that I had imagined. I don't know that I had been kissed yet, and I don't think I had. So it was like part of the universe became meaningless for me. One more obstacle removed from my path to becoming Preston Epps. Now I don't have to. But Sammy got off me, and Julie, a much bigger girl planted on me. You know, it was actually a very nice thing for these people to be doing. But there have been years when, and I still think about it, obviously. It's what I'm trying to exorcise. So. There have been years when I thought maybe it was a plot. And it was just the laughing stock from, where did we come from? Wyoming. Well, the thing is, Julie kissed me. Blam. In Wyoming, all we did was go out at night with flashlights and try and paralyze night crawlers that would come up. I could feel it moving beneath me when Julie kissed me. They were going to rise and lift me up toward Julie. And here's the problem with all of this. Julie got off me, and she and Sammy stood there. And I was now, now I had data, and I picked Sammy. You ever notice that they have catering backstage? There's always carrots. There are only three vegetables on earth, according to show business: carrots, celery, and a little tiny tomato. And the carrots shouldn't be, something you eat before you go on stage. You spend your whole night playing with this fugitive shred of carrots. So I have thought at length about that. What on earth compelled me to turn away from the very thing that every cell in myself craved, which was one more kiss. Well, actually, it was just perfect for some reason. So this song is kind of a sour grapes sort of tune. I figured this is exactly what would have happened given how it all started. The place I used to live. I climbed the steps and tried the door and let myself in. The kitchen clock I used to watch had stopped at 5 to 5. A photograph I'd never seen. A car came up the drive. I stood outside the kitchen door, and when she turned her head, I said that I was back to stay. She laughed at what I said. She said that I'd grow old, believing I was what mattered most. That I'd uncover real feelings when I steps and tried the door and let myself in. Story, this next song. I'm telling you, it won't sound like it, but it's true. You can steal a menudo from the back of Pizza Town. That was the beginning of the start. You've been taking the tequila up until the after hours, but don't you take it too hard. It's been 5 long years since you ride the train to Chico. Now you're in the back of a truck, but that's what's from robbing the last train to Chico. Goodbye. And Enrico, good luck. James Dean's old house in North Hollywood. He owned, I think, about 63 of them. And he was standing near a fireplace. He was leaning near a fireplace. Wasn't on the, maybe he thought he was on the mantelpiece, but it's just, you know. Extraordinary. Probably probably his biggest hit is Tiki Torches at Twilight, which I wish I could render for you now, but I just, David Lindley did it so perfectly that I don't dare. Tiki Torches, Tiki Torches at Twilight. They're lining up at the bars. All the men from the office are throwing up in their cars. Oh. He had so many of them. Groundhog Day on Mars. Martians at the window, and you in my arms, put down that antenna. Don't broadcast your charm. That's wonderful. Now, there are certain pillars of the culture, and most of them, I'm beginning to think, go unnoticed. But they're holding up the world, and I guess that's fine. I would like to call attention to a couple of them, Frisbee and one of them, and a maniac, really, I guess, named Chester Gould, who invented and drew Dick Tracy for something like, I mean maniac in the best possible way. He was a wonderful cartoonist because he violated many of the rules of draftsmanship. If one of his characters needed to pick up a glass of beer and the beer was 5 feet away, the guy just grew a 5 foot long arm. He didn't, no apologies, corners that made no sense. It was a kind of an Escher approach to crime detection. And of course, the villains who are all distorted in some way, prune face, and there's a billion of them. And as a kid, I was deeply involved with his comic strip. It was better than Cheyenne, where I was living. So I lived there instead. And on Sundays, at the top of the page that he had, there was something called, it was a little panel, had two holes drawn on it so that you could cut it out and mount it in your binder filled with Crime Stoppers textbook. Each little frame, one every Sunday, the one that I remember, and I did collect them for a while, was to line up all of the hangers in your closet facing in one direction so that when the arsonist that you live next door to just, there's 15 on every block as far as Chester Gould is concerned, you can reach in there and lift them all out at once. And they won't burn up like the rest of your house if you run out of the front door. It's strangely brilliant that somebody would take the time and the effort to think of that, invent the whole concept, Crime Stoppers textbook, and set out to make the world a safer place to live. This song, the last character that I can remember really getting involved with, because Mr. Gould began to kind of lose it, I think. Dick Tracy went to the moon in his yellow hat, and he rode around in a little sort of moon pod. along with B.O. Plenty, and everybody was going to the moon. Chester went there first. And I lost interest, but his greatest character was not Flat Top, it was Flat Top Jr., who looked exactly like Flat Top because he was, being a junior, related somehow. I don't know if it was ever even explained how. And was he a son, a nephew? We don't know. So, you know, like who was Homer, really? We don't know who were Flat Top Jr.'s antecedents. And we'll never know. But you don't care after a while because Flat Top, like all of the major villains in his oeuvre, in Chester Gould's oeuvre, lived in an odd place. The mole, lived in a propane tank in a heavy equipment yard. I forget who. Let's call him Mole 2. He lived in a tank. In a city park. And in both cases, these things were fitted out with bunks, you know, hot plates, shortwave radios, escape hatches, tunnels. And that's all I wanted. I hadn't moved to Muskogee yet, and I just wanted to live like that. I wanted my own little odd container. I thought it was the coolest thing. But my favorite was Flat Top Jr., who lived in his car. And as a result, became the first person to prefigure the rise of the RV. Along with the author, William Faulkner. He did the same thing. They're joined forever at the hip. They were separated at birth, but they were joined forever at the hip. You can hear Faulkner reading a passage in Sartorus where he talks about people having more and more to do with their cars until eventually they move into their cars and they move down the road living in their cars, and eventually the cars, as if of their own mind, begin to extend patios. This is the guy that got the Nobel Prize, you know, for lyrics. And he was right. He was right. And so was Chester Gould. And was Flat Top Jr., he had a television set, he had a shortwave radio, he had something to cook in, he had special compartments for his guns and his shoes. He had these tennis shoes. It was just nuts. And in the last panel before he died in a barrel of pickle brine on a flatbed rail car, because they curve in at the top. He jumped in to hide and then he couldn't get out. They always died great, just great deaths. And in this last panel, he's taking a bath in the trunk of his car. And the lid of the trunk is up, he's kind of leaning back, and he has a scrub brush in one hand, and he's humming a little tune. You can tell because of the two eighths notes drawn above it amidst the bubble. I'd like to play it for you now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Some people would, you know, have two guitar cables, so they wouldn't have to go through all that. What am I? You know. There's a sort of scurrilous, you know, book called Dreamcatcher that was written by the daughter of Salinger, Franny and Zooey. Catcher in the Rye. And the book really kind of just takes him apart, and not entirely. I mean, leaves him. There's some cheerful, affectionate passages toward the old man, but I just got infuriated after a while, and what's the point of that? But I did, and in the middle of it all, she prints the first verse of a poem written by Christina Rossetti called "In the Bleak Midwinter." It's one of the great little bitty verses that I'm aware of. Captures the whole thing. I live in the bleak midwinter. In April, it's bleak where I go. At least 2 hours every day when I'm about to play. And you get they have things, a thing here that you will have seen called a ghost light. It's when the stage is empty and the room is empty. In the middle of the night, there's a light bulb on a stand burning. And that's there. It's a ghost light. It's called that because it keeps the ghosts of other performances off the stage so that the next performance can survive and get its mojo going when it's out here without, you know, the cast of Oklahoma stomping all over you. Anita Baker comes by, you know, and where in the hell have you been? But it's a fact that you can feel all of that. You're feeling something when you get to stand in the wings. It's a wonderful feeling. And this song for me captures that. And there are other verses to this poem, but they frankly suck. They just don't make it. The first verse does. That's why I will hear it twice tonight. It has another resonance for me, which is that I froze my feet one year in Minnesota, got stuck, girlfriend's abandoned in the car as I go to get help at a truck stop, which I have two ways of approaching. I can go all the way back down the dirt road we were on to the highway, and then come back down the highway, which is just, you know, it's practically the same line as the road, the dirt road, but and come right here to the truck stop. Well, I got stuck there. The truck stop is here. Why do I want to go that way and that way? Because if you go this way, you'll probably die. I didn't know that. It was 28 below. There was an 80 below wind chill. I jumped into this farmer's field. The snow was halfway up my thighs. I took one step, lost You know, I took one step, I'm all right. I take the next step, and I lose that boot and the shoe in it. And I thought, oh. And I reached back. There's two, what is that, one? I reached back to, it's right there. You can see the hole where the boot would be. I couldn't find the boot. Try it some, well, don't. But I couldn't find the boot, so I took another step. Lost that boot. Sounds impossible, doesn't it? It's very doable. And I'm close to the truck stop. It was as near as maybe the back of the room here. Very close. I could hear what they were saying. See the, you know, people running around going, boy, it's cold out here. And I passed out twice in this little field. Just pulling that damn leg out of that snow that one more time was too much. And went to the hospital, they were going to amputate my feet. Somebody knew my grandmother. Came in, happened to be on call the next day, saw my name on the surgery list, stopped that shot that, you know, sets you up. And he said, look, we can take this a half an hour at a time and I might be able to save your feet. He said, but it's not likely. And if we do this, we run the risk of gangrene and then we'll have to take off more than your feet. And I said, okay. You could die in this process if it really takes hold. It's all right. I was young, you know. Nothing fazed me. So, I just want to, you know, here's my feet. And I just wanted to, you should have seen them then. Wow. In the bleak midwinter. One more time. Carrots. If I feel the urge to tell you any more of stuff like that, I'll just write it down and mail it to you. In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan. The earth as hard as iron, water turned to stone. Snow is poured, snow on snow, snow on snow on snow. Thank you. Down when you touchdown. You'll find that it's stranger than known. Signs in the street that say where you're going are somewhere just being their own. Among those afraid of losing their ground, rain gray town, known for its sound, in places, small faces unbound. Small faces thank you. that song was written in the Roosevelt Hotel. Oh, now I blocked his name. Clark. Not Guy Clark. At any rate, and he called the other guys in the band, the Birds, and he said, "I've got this great song. It's called 6 Miles High. Come on up." They all went up to his room, heard the song change 6 to 8. That was all they did. And he lost 75% of the publishing on the biggest hit they ever had. Excuse me. If there's any of that water back there, chase that carrot really well. Somebody could just bring it out here. I don't know. It doesn't have to be smooth. It just shouldn't hurt, that's all. Professional entertainer. Every time. I remember playing, it was my first concert in Dusseldorf. I'd never been in Dusseldorf. And it was a weird room. It was a flat floor, no rake. It wasn't really a concert hall, but they had put a stage in there. They poured one in it with concrete. This huge, enormous, rectangular slab, and I just stiffed every breath, everything was just like being cement, and I couldn't get over. I just couldn't find my place. I couldn't find them. And you learn after a while that's fine too. It's just. You can enjoy it for what it is, a complete failure. You really can. It's like being invisible, and we've all fantasized about that and to some extent. But I didn't really know that at the time, so it was misery, and I ground my way through the set. You wonder why they stay when it's that bad. You know, why do they just go home and we can all leave? But finally it was done. I said, see you. And headed off towards stage right. It was very dark over there. I took a step, fell off the stage. And the crowd roared. It just exploded. Iggy Pop got his start. Wait, if I do this every night, what if I hit myself with a microphone? Got it somewhere? Oh, okay. You don't take drugs, do you? I have been, I trust you. I'm just making a joke. I don't mean that. But I came out one night. I had to. Anyhow. You know, there's a rule. You don't eat the food. It's happened to me twice. But you can drink the water. Thank you. completely, that blew it. See, what happens is you don't, like I said, you come out here and you just vanish, and something is here, and you just hope it doesn't humiliate you. But if you actually become in some way personally engaged or something, you know, like your foot's on fire or something, you know, you can't go back. It's like trying to remember a dream, you know. Oh, wait a minute, let me think about this. Oh, yeah. Well, I might have been done, actually. I think I was done. Okay, I'm going to play, but I have to tell you this. Along those lines, Homer and Jethro, when at the height of their career, which I think was in the 60s, they were incredibly hot act, mandolin and guitar, and hilarious, and both of them just virtuosos. And you know, and then they had sold out everywhere. They're on this big national tour, and they came to one of the Carolinas to play a ballroom, and nothing had been sold. Usually when you hear that, it means you've sold about 100 tickets. Nothing, not one ticket had been sold for this 1,000 person, I guess it would be seats in a ballroom facility. So Homer and Jethro said, well, that's fine, but we're tired and we'd like a night off, and you know, we'll give you back the advance and that'll be it. And promoters said, no, there might be a walk-up. And Homer told me this. I mean, Jethro told me this story when we were doing a show with Steve Goodman. And he said, we played, which I think is just heroic. It's one of those great gestures, you know. And they played. And he said, it remained zero. Nobody came. You could hear the crickets, of course, but you could hear the transformer humming on the telephone pole across the street. And they played, he said, we played our whole set, everything we knew, knocked it out of the park, and we walked off, and we came back on and took an encore.
Thank you.
I was born in Saginaw, Michigan. I grew up in a house on Saginaw Bay. My dad was a poor, hard-working Saginaw fisherman. Too many times he brought home too little pay. I loved a girl in Saginaw, Michigan, daughter of a wealthy, wealthy man. But he called me that son of a Saginaw fisherman, not good enough to claim his daughter's hand. Now I'm up here in Alaska, digging in the cold, cold ground. Like a crazy fool, I'm digging in this frozen ground, so cold. Now I'm up here in Alaska, up here in Alaska, looking around for gold. Like a crazy fool, I'm digging in this frozen ground, so cold. With each new day I pray I'll strike it rich and then go back home and claim my love in Saginaw, Michigan. Thank you. Started out as Jesus Maria, written by the enormously great Carla Bley, and then I fell off that stage and into something else that I wrote recently. I read a wonderful book about Bill Evans, written by a piano player named Pettinger. Mentions in there a recording that Bill Evans made with Toots Stillman's. And Toots wanted to do something modular, moving between F and A. I thought, well, I can do that. I saw Bill Evans when I was in the Navy. In 1964, he was playing at about 3 in the afternoon in a bistro. It's such a strange sight. This is amazing. Well, oh, phew. Let me consult the device. Not that Ed knows any better, but at least I've, you know, shucked the responsibility. I'll close with this. I probably shouldn't, because it's not the customary kind of thing that, you know, you would close with, but I mainly want to do it because I haven't done it yet. And if I don't do it now, I won't ever. So, it's called Ants. And it's called Ants because, first of all, I'm trying to avoid the sort of titles that I have to live with now for the rest of my life. And because I had been reading a book about ants. As a matter of fact, I just sampled it again, it's a collection of my photographs of every ant genus on Earth, of all genera of ant. For each genus, there is one representative who won out in a, you know, the person who went in the county, then the state. And it's a portrait, just like this, of an ant. about as big as a house, this ball face. And it's, I mean, if you get the book, I bought, you know, they only published one copy and I got it. It's fascinating. You know, there are over 120 genera of ant on the earth. There's one genus of us. Bye-bye. The ants are next. Actually, who's to say they aren't running things right now? They spend their time, as we all know, attacking each other, it seems, what's new. But they each have developed, you know, there's these adaptive things. That, one of them that I had heard of is it has a hose on it. You can see it in the pig. They're born with a hose on the front of their forehead. You can't tell me it's not a forehead. I don't know what, you know, an entomologist calls it, or a bug. The hose, and it squirts formic acid, it melts the other ant. Excuse me, it's my hose, I'm sorry. It has a mind of its own. That one's gonna do pretty well. I mean, if they're gonna winnow each other out. There's one that is almost invisible straight on, and this is with an electron microscope. I mean, you can tell. It's just you can't tell, but it's, you know what I'm saying. And I think after you go through this thing, and there's over 120 of them, you begin to see this developing, and you zero in on them, and you write stories for all of them. You know what they're going to do. The one that's sideways goes down the neighboring ants. Hole and lines up. You don't know it's there, and then it just turns sideways, and the other ants freak out. They have. What's that called? It's called something other than death. It's called broken heart syndrome. You just freak out and. Actually, if that should happen to you, you're not having a heart attack. And you will recover in 72 hours. The problem is, it's without extensive testing, it's hard to tell that. And by treating you for what looks perfectly like a heart attack, they will kill you. If you went to a Britney Spears concert, you wouldn't hear stuff like that. Some of these ants have 13 eyes. Why? If you're an ant, you're short. There's dirt in front of you, dirt behind you. You live in dirt. There's dirt above you. What do you need 13 eyes for? Let's go take in views. What do you say? I'm just thinking of life, you know, like, I mean, just imagine. Cows too, come on. So, but there's one ant that I think, if all of this gets worked out and they wind up with one, as it did apparently with us, I mean, there were the Neanderthals and the Venusians, they were prominent here at one time, according to some people. Probably aren't people. I think the winner is going to be the one that it's just a knob. You get the portrait, there's nothing there. It's just blank. There's no feelers that I can remember, mandibles. Doesn't eat, doesn't do anything, can't see here, it's just a knob. You wouldn't think that that would be the surviving genus of all these 120, but it will be, because I know what it does. It goes down the neighboring ant hole, whether it's the invisible ant or the one with 13, I imagine the ant's a 13-eyed one, because it goes down there and it just presents an existential question. Just by being there. If you've got 13 ways of seeing that, you're gone right there. So I'm going to play this all the ants and wonderful review.
Thank you.
new Pamela Brown, but my slide has disappeared somewhere. By the way, I am the only slide in the history of the Earth that has been in space. They carried it up on the first rocket, pilot Melville, the private scaled composites rocket, which you can now fly up on if you have 200 grand. Except there's a long waiting list, so maybe 400 grand would work better. But they did that. In a kind of weight sensitive effort, they put a brass slide in there. When the pilot arrived in space for the first time privately, just a bunch of guys in Mojave, he floated some M&Ms so you could see the weightlessness. He stuffed them in the pocket of his sleeve. And when he came back, his wife was the first person in the rocket, if that's what they call it, the spaceship, really, after it landed, to pick up the M&Ms that were laying around. This company began as a kit company. You could buy the long easy, the very easy, build it. And if you, well, I won't go into that, but. And Melville, the pilot who floated the M&Ms and was the first civilian to do this, going to space, was the first guy to buy one of the kits and finish it, build it. Flew it out to meet Bert Rutan, and Bert remembered him, put him in space, along with a slide.